our world is so dominated by the importance of companies and corporations and other forms of power besides the state that we start to see things like the East India Company become interesting to people as a way of thinking through those problems. My name is Philip Stern. I'm a historian at Duke University. My work focuses on the history of the British Empire and of colonialism more generally, as well as history of the corporation and the history of the relationship between business and government in the 17th to the 19th centuries.
Welcome to Subject Matter Tabletop,
the podcast about board games and the subject matter that animates them. I'm Steve Gotzler.
And I am Jordan Tynes. We are excited to be here today.
Very excited. We are here in the Greenlaw Game Room at the University of North Carolina, the base of operations for the Critical Game Studies program here at UNC. And we are about to play
John Company,
second edition. Very excited to be featuring this game on an episode of the podcast. I don't know if listeners will know necessarily, but certainly people who know me personally will know that I have been long fascinated and sort of almost obsessively interested in this particular board game. So I'm very excited to play it today with only the most appropriate of experts, Dr. Philip Stern from Duke University. Thank you so much for joining us, Phil.
I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for having me, and really happy that John Company could have us cross enemy lines.
That's right. We're going to get into the game a little bit later, but I think we probably want to start off by having the listeners get to know you a little bit. So can you tell us a little bit about what it is that you do in your research and why we might have asked you to play this game with us?
Yeah, so I'm a historian of primarily the British Empire, but increasingly of ways of thinking about colonialism in the global context. My work started in the early modern period, the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, but recently has extended into the 20th centuries. A bunch of years ago, and I think probably one of the reasons why you have me here, about a decade ago, I published a book called The Company State, which was a history of the East India Company in the period before it supposedly turned into a territorial empire in the middle of the 18th century, looking at the ways in which it, as a corporation and as a form of commercial body in the 17th and 18th centuries, it exerted forms of political power and authority. And one of the interesting things about this game, which we'll probably get to, is that it actually starts in the middle of the period that book was looking at, so it really thinks about that transition and the ways in which we can think about how a company can be both a form of government and a form of merchant at the same time.
Right.
And recently, I've just published in the last year a book called Empire Incorporated, which kind of took off from that and thought a little bit about the ways in which corporations and companies and private enterprise generally informed and really shaped the British Empire from its very origins in the 16th century through to decolonization in the 20th. So I'm really excited about this. I actually didn't know about this game before you brought it to my attention. I've looked at other ways of playing that the East India Company has sort of been engaged with, as well as other ways it's showed up in popular culture. So I'm super interested in the interpretation that's here. So I'm looking forward to talking about it.
So I guess maybe I should explain a little bit more for people what the game is. Mm-hmm. We said John Company Second Edition, like everyone knows what that is. Mm-hmm. But John Company Second Edition is a multiplayer political negotiation sort of economic simulation game about the East India Company during the 18th and 19th century. So we will be playing as various English families who are running this company sort of together, sort of against one another to make some money and buy fancy stuff, essentially. That's who we are, and that's what we care about.
It is notorious for being complex, but I would say that a more appropriate way of describing it is that it is sprawling.
Yes.
That the systems this game uses are not incredibly complex in and of themselves, but there are so many of them.
Yeah. It's like an octopus of a game.
Yes.
It's got lots of different little idiosyncratic rule sets that all sit together and overlap.
Well, and I was going to say complex and sprawling are two words you could probably use to define the East India Company and to think about colonialism more generally. So in a way, it seems fairly appropriate. Mm.
Yeah, and it's also notoriously long.
Yes.
The game, if you play the full version of the game, it can go up to and actually probably often exceeds 6 hours of playtime.
It really depends on how long you spend haggling with each other over deals.
Yes.
They could be there all day. Yeah.
So that's, we'll hear more about the game. So let's shift back though to your expertise. If you were going to explain what a corporation was to somebody who was not from planet Earth, how would you do that?
Right.
Historically speaking, what is a corporation?
Because they're sort of ubiquitous. We understand that they're everywhere, but they didn't always exist, right? So what are corporations? What makes them historically specific, and how do they emerge?
That's right. It's a really good question. I think about this a lot. We've come to have certain assumptions with that, associations with that word. We need to think a little about the history and how corporations have changed and evolved over time. So we think of a corporation today, I think you hear the word and you think some multinational, sprawling and like complex business organization.
Disney, Apple,
Microsoft, Amazon or something like that. I mean, those are corporations, right? But cities are corporations as well. I mean, if anybody lives in a town or city that you see the sign when you walk in, incorporated in such and such a time, or universities, North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Duke University, these are places that are also corporations. So a corporation is essentially a legal tool that allows for a group of people generally to act as a single body. It's in the name, corpus, body. That is fundamentally what a corporation is in law. And that idea has evolved over time. It surprises most people when they learn that the idea itself actually arose in medieval Europe, not out of business interests largely, but actually in the church, in the Catholic Church, as a way of organizing ways of thinking about the legal rights of different communities with relation to one another, in relation to the government of the papacy. And at the same time, it also emerged in the empires of medieval Europe, something like the Holy Roman Empire, before there were these overseas empires, as a ways of thinking about the rights of cities and organizations. In other words, the corporation is a way of sort of ordering rights and responsibilities and privileges of groups of people so they can act in law with one voice and as one name. In fact, the name of a corporation, many legal theorists in the medieval and early modern period said, was its basic function, to give the thing a name so you could identify it. We think about that today. If we think about, you know, we often use names of companies as nouns, you know, Apple does this, or Amazon does this, but in fact, you're talking about groups of people, lots of moving parts, lots of competing agencies, but it's a way of thinking about them together. And over time, that tool evolved, as law will do, to take different forms, including now where, you know, a single individual could be a corporation or have a corporation in their name, and it does all these other things. The last point is that there's another kind of legal entity that gets met up with the corporation over time, and that's the joint stock company, which is what something like the East India Company is. And that's a particular way of organizing business of various sorts. I mean, you had joint stock companies for commerce, but you also had joint stock companies that were involved in missionary activity. You had joint stock companies interested in philanthropy. And joint stock is essentially, and people will be familiar with this today, but won't sort of think about its alternatives, is a way of essentially where individuals pay in money of some sort for part ownership of that company. So unlike a simple partnership, if you or I were to go into business together, we wouldn't necessarily be a joint stock. We would pull all our money in, and that money would be at risk. Either we'd make money or we'd lose money, and we might go out of business, we might go bankrupt, we might not. In joint stock, you're kind of taking money from people who made money in all kinds of different places, who buy pieces, or what we now call shares. At the time of the early East India Company, they would have called them maybe dividends, that is to say, pieces that are divided up of the company. And we now still have that word in the money that often, that annuities or stock pays out, the dividend. This was a way of hedging against risk. It was a way of raising more capital, but it was also a form of government, because in a joint stock company, the shareholders in different forms have some say in how the company is governed, either by electing people or by voting directly in some way. And you sort of see this this function in corporations as well. So when the two kind of come together in the 16th and 17th centuries, people start to think, oh, we can make joint stock companies into corporations and vice versa. You have a whole new way of organizing trade or other forms of economic activity that inherently have a kind of political claim, because corporation is, in a sense, a form of government, and a form of legal right. And that's the context in which the East India Company emerges when it's created in 1600, is after decades of experimentation with this form for other forms of overseas expansion, exploration, colonization, and commerce.
This form of government, this form of government which sort of blends these sort of new kinds of economic forms and joint stock with this form of like political or legal identity as a corporation or a corporate body. In what way do these things participate in or inform the formation of states, of modern states, and like of empires over the course of this period?
The history across the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, as we start to see modern states like the United Kingdom, France, the United States, India come into being, is in a dynamic relationship with all of these other things we call private enterprise, like these corporations, that are bringing in revenue, fighting wars, bringing the state into those conflicts, the state bringing those corporations into those conflicts. I'm often asked, well, who's in charge, the state or the corporations? And I think it's not a question that you can answer at any given time. It's a kind of back and forth and a dynamic between the two. And the East India Company is a prime example. It's what drew me to writing about it in the first place. I mean, my interest as a historian was in kind of how British India came to be, but I also came to be increasingly interested in just what the relationship between different forms of political community are, because I think we tend to, and again, we'll go back to your point about explaining something to someone not from planet Earth. As a historian, as a teacher, one of my favorite things to do is to take people from planet Earth, from who are embedded in things they just take for granted, like governments or states are fully in charge of all aspects of government, and to look more closely at it and to realize that actually there's a real dynamic both within states where there's different moving parts, and then between what you might think of as public and private. And the only one thing I would add to that is that I think that even distinction between public and private is something we need to think more clearly about. Is the East India Company acting as a private or a public entity? Is a company that runs a prison acting as a private or public entity? These
standing
kinds of things.
Armies, that sort
right.
of stuff.
Or, you know, mercenary armies in this period we all think of as kind of private, but they're really very public bodies that do a lot of self-governing of the people underneath them. And that's something corporations do, which is they essentially govern the people that are members of the company.
So crucially negotiated like treaties with foreign powers.
Absolutely.
Right, and that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's a tendency to want to think of that from a modern perspective as the state outsources its, it's outsourcing its responsibilities. But if you look at it historically, they're kind of both jostling for position and power in a whole world that's got, you've got pirates and you've got mercenaries. You've also got states that are, we don't think of as governments, like the Catholic Church. You have empires. Right. You have states inside of other states and autonomous states and cities that have their own rights and responsibilities. So this is a world where you can't just color a whole area and call it England or call it France. You have to think, you realize that inside of those maps that we're used to seeing are much more complex and shifting arrangements at all times.
One of the things that this game does really well that we're going to be asking you to reflect on through play and discuss with us afterwards is put you in the position of people who are theoretically running this corporation, this company.
Yeah.
And I am interested to know from you, what were the ideals that people had when they were pursuing the formation of a state like this, or a government like this, or a corporation, to use the term that we're playing through today.
Maybe I should back up very quickly about the East India Company to give a sense of this, which is that the East India Company is founded in 1600.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1750s and 1760s, about 150 years later, the company, and we can talk about this a little more as we get into the game, because that's kind of actually what a bunch of this game is focused on. The East India Company comes into an immense amount of territorial power, the power to collect revenue, the power to assert justice, and to run courts, and of course, all fueled by its growing army. For a very, very long time, the story about the East India Company was that it had been a commercial body. It had been doing this trading stuff from 1600 to the 1750s, when it kind of somehow accidentally or backed into or because of contingent circumstances fell into this territorial power the book that I wrote, and I think other people have also, you know, been thinking about this recently, questioned that idea that there was this sharp break. Mm-hmm. So I suppose you're preaching to the choir here when you ask, did the, you know, when the company was created or through its long history in that first part of the period, first part of its history, did it have political ideals? Because the way historians have tended to treat it is no, their political ideal was profit.
Money.
Like money. And they would do anything to make money. And there were, and I went into the archives and did all this reading and saw them talking about things like justice. Saw them talking about things about law. And when I say justice, I don't mean some absolute sense of justice. I mean their own idea of what was right and wrong, which we may look back on now and most certainly do and think, yeah, there's a lot wrong with their idea of what's right and wrong. But that's an ideology, yeah. And we can find it problematic and abhorrent, which I think we probably should. But at the time, they're sort of constituting their ideas based upon philosophies. And so the answer is absolutely. The thing is that like any political community, any state, any group of people, even probably among the three of us, you're going to have some shared ideas, but you're going to have a lot of disagreements and arguments. Mm-hmm. The East India Company, because it's not one thing, but it's governed by a board of directors, or what was called a court of committees in its early period. It has a director or a governor in that early period. It has shareholders. This game, which we'll get into later, also very cleverly understands the kind of problematic dynamics between the company and the English and the later British states. We'll get to it, I guess, but there's a phase where one has to deal with Parliament, yes. Right?
So we have this lovely, brightly colored Prime Minister wheel.
Yeah, exactly. It's even literally a wheel of fortune, right? So, so those ideological battles. Should the company be interested in territory or should it be interested in trade? If you're interested in territory or you're settled in particular places, what should the nature of your government be? What does political participation look like? What should taxation look like? And so, the other thing is that a lot of these ideologies are not just strictly political, but a kind of political economy. So thinking about what's the proper way to grow a settlement? Do you have high taxes or low taxes? Do you have high interest rates or low interest rates? What is the nature of the political participation of South Asians and other non-Europeans or even other non-Britons in your settlements in these, so there's all of these layers and dynamics. So I didn't quite answer your question about what they were thinking because there was no one
right.
set of thought. But the one thing that I can say is that pretty consistently amongst the people that are running the East India Company or working for it is this idea that the East India Company is the owner of not only its property, but also of its rights of government that we were talking about before, that it acquires through these kinds of treaties, through these negotiations on the ground. And that's going to be something that most of the leadership of the East India Company is going to defend, regardless of what their political position is. And the other thing I would just add is that it is impossible to talk about the East India Company or any agent of empire, whether it's a state or a company, without thinking about an underlying racism. And that racism is a very 17th and 18th century style that is very much rooted in ideas of religious difference, of geographical difference. And it doesn't come off as exactly like we might expect it to in the 21st century. And if we want to talk about that, we can get into it. But there is fundamentally our fundamental ideas under this about the difference between Europe and the rest of the world that inform their arguments and ideas about why you need an army in the first place, why you need a company, how you engage in these kinds of negotiations. The East India Company, anything like the East India Company, it's not just a business concern. It has a cultural presence. I think one of the things this game is really interested in thinking about is the way the East India Company impacts culture in Britain. Mm-hmm. And a lot of historians over the last many years have been very interested in pointing out that empire didn't just happen out there. It happens right. at home right. as well, yeah. and it changes everything. I mean, all you need to do is think about how integral tea is to right. British culture,
yeah, of course.
And you realize that this is all the East India Company is doing in its kind of origins. So the East India Company, very much internal to itself, has a set of rules and cultures. People think of themselves as belonging to that company, not just those who run it or fund it, but ship captains, soldiers, employees, and very much think of themselves as inside when others are outside. Mm-hmm. At the same time, mm-hmm. and you'll all know this, anybody listening who owns stock Well, no, you don't just own stock in one company. Mm-hmm. You might not even have, directors of one company might also be end up being on mm-hmm. boards or directors of other companies. One, I might get the statistics wrong, so no one write in and correct me, mm-hmm. but I think in the 1750s, the time of the great controversy over the East India Company's territorial expansion, 1/3 of parliamentarians owned stock in the East India Company.
Wow.
But then, but ask yourself the question, so does that mean Parliament is controlling the East India Company or the East India Company is controlling Parliament?
Right.
It's not a straightforward answer. And what historians have kind of said is that actually it's neither. It's just that you see, going back to your question about ideology, you just see the debates in one reflected in debates in the other.
In the book, you talk about venture colonialism. It's this wonderful phrase that you use to describe this whole set of like political and legal technologies that were used to kind of like build these state formations as empires. But this game is not about like companies. It's about the company, right? The East India Company. So listening to, and the East India Company is kind of notorious, right? In the historical record. And is that really just down to these things you've been pointing to? Its size, its duration, and this like wider cultural impact that it had? Or is it entirely unique from these other more run-of-the-mill ventures in other ways?
I think the reason we think of the English East India Company as particularly iconic is because of the emergence of the British Empire in India in the 18th and 19th centuries. This is what became, as Queen Victoria and others, you know, famously put it, the jewel in the crown, British Empire, right? I mean, it was one of the most valuable, one of the largest centers of British power. And the East India Company literally governed that part of the British Empire until 1858. So that's part of it. I think part of it is also what the game is getting at, which are all the different ways in which it infused into British culture. So all of this, I mean, think about it. Some, you know, listeners, especially if the listener come from the United States, you'll think about what is one of the most iconic moments in the American Revolution. It's this moment where a bunch of Bosteners go onto an East India Company ship and throw all this tea overboard, the Boston Tea Party.
Destroyed an
East India Company ship and is a protest against the East India Company. It's just in kind of all of these different places. But I do think that in some way also it's come back lately because, and one of my interests in it, one of the reasons I do the work I do, is because I think in the second half of the 20th century, but even more recently towards the turn of the 21st century, our world is so dominated and our politics and political culture so dominated by the importance of companies and corporations and other forms of power besides the state that we start to see things like the East India Company become interesting to people as a way of thinking through those problems. Like, how do you think about the global power of large multinational corporations? For better or for worse, one of the ways you can do that is through the East India Company. I think it leads to some insights. It also, because history is all about context, it sometimes leads to some misguided conclusions. But either way, I think that's the other reason we go back to it.
Real briefly, could you tell us, looking at the board and knowing what you know about the game right now, what are your biggest hesitations?
So my first hesitation, again, I want to say this with a caveat. I actually think this is really well done. It is a very complex and thoughtful way of engaging with this with the East India Company. My first reaction is looking at this, there's a map of India in front of me to the right on the board from my perspective. And that my first hesitation is that the East India Company's vision of the world was not just India. I know it's in the name, but in fact, when the East India Company was created in 1600, and even up to the moment, this is the starting of 1710, it conceptualized its operations as the East Indies. So you also have, for example, in what is now currently Indonesia, factories, which are trading posts. Eventually, and I know that China works into this game in a kind of oblique way, but it's not on the map that we're looking at.
Right.
There's also connections to the Middle East and Arabia, ultimately, not in a territorial way. So my first hesitation is, even though I think India is very much at the center of what happens in the 18th century, we're not getting the whole story spatially. The second thing I would think about is related to what I was just talking about, which is the East India Company was as much a territorial empire as it was a maritime empire. You remember, it's sending out these very heavily gunned, heavily manned ships halfway around the world. And shipping is part of the game, but the way in which, say, the East India Company's, for lack of a better term, navy is operating in relation to the territory is not something that we're seeing. And the third thing, and I have some other thoughts, but the third thing I would say is that reading through how the gameplay works, India's role or Asia's role in shaping the East India Company is very muted. And I know there's we'll get to it, there's a feature where the East India Company is affected by conflicts in India. But if you compare the complexity of its vision of London politics and how it's going to the company and the rather kind of simple way in which the very complex environment of politics and finance and military operations among various Indian states in this period, various Indian empires that are very much part of what's going on with the East India Company, that part is not included. And I say all that kind of sensitive to the fact that I don't know what else you could put in this game that's not going to be playable, so I totally understand that.
Sure.
And I do want to say, on a positive side, I think, to give it credit, I think the game is about the London or British aspects of the company and how they manifest in India. So in some sense, that level of emphasis is really quite mm-hmm. smart. And so those are all the historical things I've noticed, but honestly, that is a nerdy scholar quibbling with what I think is actually really quite a complicated way of thinking about the company.
Yeah.
Really.
One last question before we switch over to play. Not as a historian, as a gamer, what is your autobiography?
Yeah, your experience with play of any kind.
Yeah, it's a good question. I was expecting you to ask me. So I'm not, I think probably by your standards, not a very sophisticated or extensive gamer. I have played, I am a big fan, though probably don't play as much these days as I once did, or would be interested in doing, in this kind of game and strategy games. So as far as board games go, for example, I mean, obviously some of the childhood favorites like Risk were games I was super into. But over the years, I've played things like Axis and Allies or Catan or games that I think have similar kinds of ways of going about things. But I don't think I have a ton of experience with it, to be honest. I've also, similarly with video games as well, like, you know, honestly, for a long time, it was mostly just exclusively sports games for a bit.
Sure.
I did go through a phase, I will admit, in graduate school, I think when I was trying to avoid my work, of being deep into Civilization.
Mm, nice.
So this is very much up the alley of things I'm interested in, though I wish I had more experience with it, but I'm looking forward to doing it.
Cool. Great. Cool. Well, let's give it a shot.
Yeah, let's get to it. Now it's time for the slightly longer than 2-minute teach, where we explain the game briefly, go over the rule set, and talk about a few key aspects of the game before we sit down to play it. John Company is a game about the British East India Company. Players take on the role of families, whose members jockey for control, profit, and power among the various offices of the company across a roughly 100-year span of its historical operations from 1710 to 1813. To secure victory, players must parlay their positions within the company to purchase garish luxuries, marry prestigious spouses, and retire to prized stately homes, all while staving off blowback from the company's potential failure. In the process, John Company reveals the mundanely personal and often morally bankrupt motives that lie at the root of empire building and its historical machinations. John Company is an ambitious and sprawling game that blends simple mechanics like area control, voting, and dice checks within a complex tapestry of overlapping systems. Part role-playing game, part economic strategy crunch, part negotiation endurance test, John Company thrusts players into a semi-cooperative epic about running a state-sponsored monopoly. The grubby deals, calculated risks, and decision-making dilemmas which arise at the table emerge within a narrative space peppered with debt restructuring, investment scandals, political betrayals, callous acts of military aggression and colonial oppression, and, of course, the fatigue of corporate leadership. Each round of John Company can be mapped along three major stages. The first of these stages presents the domestic backdrop to company affairs within the high society of London. Crucially, it is during this stage that players actively score their points by cashing in on comfortable retirements for family pensioners and securing marriages to prestigious spouses or buying lucrative private enterprises. The second stage of each round is the heart of the game. During this stage, players assume the roles of different offices responsible for the various arms of company operations.
First, players confront a layer of upper management, executing the duties of the chairman, the director of trade, manager of shipping, and military affairs to make decisions about debt financing and budget allocation. Next, players shift away from these more executive offices to company operations on the ground in India through the company's regional presidencies and governorships and the command of its private armies. At every step of the way, company operations presents players with a thicket of competing interests and mutual advantage as they haggle, cajole, and leverage each other into running the company in the manner which best serves their own family's interest, or by running it deliberately into the ground. Virtually everything is tradable in John Company. As each of the office holders act, any player may interject to offer something they possess in an attempt to sway the decision under consideration. The final stage of each round involves events in the world at large, which alter the game state for future turns. John Company offers an engrossing puzzle of economic interest and player position. Amid its heady atmosphere of risk and uncertainty, the best laid plans can be, and often are, suddenly shattered by a capricious roll of the dice. Victory belongs to the family who can best leverage their positions and their assets in ways that nimbly respond to the company's shifting landscape of power and fortune.
Player positionality is fragile in John Company. In one turn, a player may occupy the role of three powerful offices within the company, but on the very next turn, they may have been ousted from all but one, only to be replaced by their competitors. This creates a need to exercise the privileges offered by one's current company offices in ways that benefit at least one other player at the table, in order to encourage reciprocity on future turns, while at the same time making it imperative that players cash in while they can, by leveraging their positions in ways that ultimately serve their own interests. This balancing act between cooperation and competition is perhaps more palpable in every moment of gameplay in John Company than in any other game we've played to date. This feeling is especially potent for any players who find themselves working against the company. If players are thought to be anti-company, they are swiftly ostracized from the cooperative cause, locking them out of profitable opportunities and placing their family's fortunes in a dangerous position. John Company's approach to graphic and component design renders the history of British colonialism in India in multifaceted and in sometimes contradictory ways. On one hand, the map of India projects a colonizing vision of the subcontinent as a flattened space ripe for economic opportunity and military conquest. At the same time, the inhabitants of India exert a powerful influence on the game state. Though present only abstractly as a deck of beautifully illustrated event cards and sculpted pieces symbolizing sovereign regions and their political dispositions, the resolution of these events each round almost always results in changes that undermine the company's ability to control the board. Meanwhile, the London display is full of grotesque caricatures taken from political cartoons of the period, while the officeholder cards depict austere portraits of historical figures. Through this blend of visual styles, players are invited to imagine themselves as stern-faced oil paintings, marrying goofy cartoon strips and retiring to an episode of Bridgerton. The tongue-in-cheek atmosphere in London produces jarring moments of contrast with the colonization of India, pushing the entire game into a political commentary on the subject of corporate colonialism. As a result, while on its surface, John Company appears to be a historical business game, at the table, it unfolds as both simulation and satire in equal measure. I mean, do we really think the chairman image here is self-serious? He is a pretty goofy looking guy.
Yeah, he looks goofy to us.
I think you probably approved that portrait.
Yeah. What are you, chairman? You're fudging the books over here. Keep some accounting. What's going on?
I'm going to need one there.
Okay. Something. No. A little suspect about this chairman's bookkeeping. Okay. So that's the chairman.
Yeah,
right. So you spent all five.
You got to put your director of trade Steve's kicking you out on the street a little prematurely there.
If you want,
what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to move the Thistleworth to Bengal.
To these? Or that one. I'll give you my consent for nepotism.
I'll take the Cassephernet, because okay. I have Cassephernet from Icy. So
you can call in on that later, okay. Which would be great for you.
You and Jordan, you don't have
to. You should have kicked me out of there. You should have kicked me out of there. Yeah.
So
I got a one and all sixes.
Wow.
Whoa. Okay.
So two things. One, that did feel really icky.
Which is, right. You know, four die is a 80% chance of success, which seems okay. High, but a 20% chance of death is kind of right. High too, well, right? Yeah. So
that's pretty good. That's better odds than I think would have happened in reality.
Hey, you got it. Okay, so.
Right. Then how much did we
add? The company got 6, 5, 11, and 4, so 15. Top of 12 is 27.
Okay, well, loaded.
I am an expert.
You are.
So I'm going to say... Ugh, but then if I lose it, I'll pay 6. Yeah. You know, so I'll abstain.
Fraud. I'm sitting pretty with my 10 pounds.
I know.
Okay, so you're gonna let it go.
Okay. Wow, that was a even in its shortened version, a long session. Where we kind of did a very small tour of the game. We played through around giving a sense of as many features as possible. I think we covered everything.
Yeah, we pushed all the buttons. We pulled all the levers. Yes. We saw what kind of things happen.
So the first question we usually start with is, at a very high level, what do you think is being communicated by this game to a casual audience / player?
That's a really good question. I'm still processing a lot of it. I'm still trying to figure out why I made you director of trade and then, which was a terrible idea.
Well, maybe not.
So at a very high level, I think my intuition or suspicion was sort of correct, that the game is suggesting that it is, that the East India Company's victories and losses, or its successes or failure, or however you want to think about it, are really determined by its leadership and determined by what's going on in England. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get the point, and actually, I have to say you're right that the India side is very complex, but what's not involved is a politics in India. It's it's really about a success and failure of a kind of military sort or commercial sort that has to do with a bunch of randomness, which, you know, dice rolls and that sort of thing. The strategy and the choices are all London and company based. So it suggests that the directors and the government of company have a lot of power, which is very interesting because there's a bit of a debate, I think, between scholars of the East India Company, between people who think about the company as something that has a decision-making tree that, and where those decisions are made and then those decisions fan out. And then others, and particularly some scholars, especially sociologists and others who think about organizations, who sort of understand that actually what happens in the East India Company is affected by lots of things outside of the East India Company, including governments in India, as well as other companies and even those competitors. What's interesting, I'm seeing the game not as a snapshot of how the East India Company worked, but actually as a snapshot of how it worked from the perspective of those directors.
Yes.
We are playing those characters. And I think for them, India was an abstract map of moving pieces around on the board. I mean, you have some quibbles maybe with historically how you'd appoint a writer or something like that. Okay. Who cares about that right now, right? But so if you see it as, like, I think one of you was suggesting before, and I think I actually read this in an essay that the designer wrote, that thinking it more like a novel in which these new companies are a character, then is a historical snapshot of how it worked, then that's very powerful, because I think you, I began to feel in a very uncomfortable way like a director.
Yes.
And I think a lot of these people making these decisions in London or in their country estates were abstracting what India was. And as a result, you sort of get a sense of how empire can happen when it's just pieces moving around a map on a board. But at the same time, you have some skin in the game in that you have family members that are out there as well.
So can I ask you a follow-up question on that line of sort of interpretation? I mean, I think approaching it novelistically makes sense. The designer has framed it this way. You know, he said that the approach to perspective he adopted was a more kind of novelistic one. But for me, if I think of it not as a novel, but as a game, the kind of thorniest thing for me when I play this game has to do with how it deals with player position. Like, who actually are we, right? We're like not even individuals. We're sort of like intergenerational operations that are familial, and that we put these pieces out, and those pieces occupy these offices, right, that have certain powers and things like this. But I guess I'd be curious to hear from you about, like, who, like, were these people actually, right? We recognize the name Hastings. I don't know if the other names are accurate in that way. There's no Clive family, probably for the best. But who were these folks, and were they actually engaging in the kind of things that the players role-playing this game do? Like, were they blackmailing each other? Were they leveraging each other? Were they sort of extorting money from one another or embezzling money from the company?
It's an interesting point. I mean, I think there's lots of ways to answer the question. I think that what you see here is a caricature or maybe a dramatization of what the politics might have looked like. I mean, there were certainly vicious political battles inside the company at various different points. Who those played out among might not be all of these elite families. And that's the part you're asking me, sort of how this works. The East India Company is both a route for established figures, right? But also it becomes a route for people like Clive or other figures to sort of make their way into that society. And I think that's one of the basic conflicts, political conflicts or cultural conflicts. So these people coming back with all of this wealth, buying their ways into social and cultural capital, but also into estates. One of the very interesting things about this game, as a parenthetical note, is that these things like owning a shipyard or owning a workshop give you votes in parliament. But at this period, what would have given you a vote in parliament was land. Only land, right?
Got it.
Now, of course, these things can be parlayed into land. But until you get to electoral reform in the 19th century, land owning is the key to being in parliament, right? So in a way, we have on the left here these estates that you're buying. Those should give you votes. Right, when you do that in some way or something like that.
And this is a card. There's many of these in the game. What does that read to you?
So the Rotten Borough card, that's another way you get into parliament. Land is the basic way to get into parliament. But remember, this is interesting to cycle back to our earlier conversation. Remember how we were talking at the beginning when you asked me about what a corporation was?
Yeah.
And I was saying that if it was the 16th or 17th century or even the 18th century, and I said the word corporation to you in London, you probably wouldn't. Your first instinct wouldn't be to think of a commercial company. It would be to think of an urban municipality, of a city, the Corporation of London. Corporations, urban corporations, had representation in parliament as well, seats. So in a way, that is a route for more commercial power to be in London, those representatives of the Corporation of London, for example. So it is an exception to some extent, not quite without getting too much into it, to this idea that it was just landed estates, people landed estates that had. So
that's what the borough is.
Well, so the borough is
some sort of incorporated zone.
And what the rotten part of it is that's a term that comes up in the late 18th and early 19th century when people are looking to reform the system, because there were many traditional, maybe medieval municipalities that had long-standing rights to representation but no longer had really people in them.
Mm.
So there were these cities that notoriously had almost no residents but would have, you know, two seats in parliament or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, with money, and that's where I think the money part of voting gets represented. You could be representing that municipality when there's really no constituents for it. It's not that these things are absent in the game. But what I wanted to get back to, I was saying before, is that what's missing here are the cultural dislocations, the kind of ripple effects of what's going on in India. So many of these people, like Clive, who were coming back, for lack of a better way of thinking about it, were read by old society as a kind of nouveau riche class. Mm-hmm. They actually had a name for it. They called them Nabobs, which is a corruption of the Mughal title of Nawab, which was like the Nawab of Bengal was essentially the leader of the sovereign of Bengal. It was a kind of sarcastic term. Many of these caricatures of Nabobs are what you might expect of a kind of satire on nouveau riche, right? The gains were seen by some to be sort of ill-begotten, their roles in parliament to be ill-begotten. So there's a cultural conflict going on inside the company and in a wider society on the possible dangers of the way in which this money being gotten from Indian Empire is dislocating the traditional power centers of politics. And the last thing about that I'll just say is that then gets the other issue you asked me about. It treats everybody's vote kind of as equal, and it doesn't account for kind of social and political capital. Mm. Being from an established, famous family, having power outside of the company in some way or another, having family ties, my daughter is married to your son, or I've married off my son into your family or something like that.
Like alliances.
Alliances and connections at multi-generational levels would all play into this in a way that I think would be crazy to capture in the game. but I think as you asked me the question, would be, so I guess the point is that one thing that's happening in this is it's repeating that stereotype that I mentioned before, where people's interests are really quite venal, right? Their interests are either about power or profit. Mm-hmm. And even though it's replaying it in various dimensions, that's not just about company trade, my incentive here is to gain power or gain money, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing in here gives me benefit for the people I'm going to see at the club later, right, the 100 years of family connections that we've had, or the fact that I have some power in parliament, or I have some power in various other aspects of society. And remember, we talked about how the company doesn't exist in and of itself. You really want to make this game nuts. You also have a Hudson's Bay Company game going on across the table over the room, and then we have to trade across
that,
those things.
As a mega game would be kind of incredible. Why? With a John Company level complexity game for each of the companies that was happening at a different table in one big convention room, and then you have like the crown on the stage. Oh my gosh, that'd be crazy.
So if we're going with what you sort of opened with in this part of our conversation, which is this is a game about sitting at the table in London, running the company, right, in a building with your fellow colleagues, you know, working on this project that is abstracted and zoomed out from that perspective, right? So the project being sending ships somewhere else in the world and leveraging resources that place has and bringing them back here and selling them for more money. Is there a lesson that this game can teach us about that positionality that is reinforced by the materiality of this board game that's sitting on the table with us, right? That the attitude that we have in that positionality of that thing that's far away is zoomed way out from where we're sitting in London at that table. And this quibbling that we have that has this sort of zoomed in, satirical, nitty-gritty, like you and I, yes, are ultimately trying to claim money and power, mm-hmm, but we're also gaining social capital in real time sitting at this table.
Oh, that's
right here,
interesting. Yeah.
Right? I am trying to gain your trust and your
for
trust.
Negotiation
and we are
terms,
trying to develop that piece. Yeah. And so I wonder if there's a lesson to learn where we're embodying that positionality for 6 hours, probably, if we're going to play this whole game, mm-hmm, right? Where we're doing that kind of thing on repeat from that perspective. What does that tell us about the East India Trading Company and the people who occupied those positions?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really, really clever, insightful way to read it. I mean, I think with the caveat that there, unless you had a kind of mega game, there's no way of really mirroring the ways in which political and social capital and trust and affective bonds. I mean, these are human beings as well, as mm-hmm, as much as, you know, we abstract them, they have problems of trust and affection and family relations. And we all know families can cut either way. One of the assumptions in this game, for example, is that, you know, you're all in support of your family, but families can be just like corporations. There could be a fight and battling among sons, for example, for position and things like that. So two things, I guess, I'm seeing. One is what it is capturing is the degree to which these decisions get abstracted from the reality on the ground, right? Mm. You're making even the order of gameplay, right? Mm-hmm. You're making all these kinds of appointments and decisions in one place, and then things happen in India, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. What you're getting is a picture of kind of how empire happens, right? So in the 19th century, the sociologist Herbert Spencer, who was also, by the way, early in his career, an employee of a railway company, wrote this essay where he basically made this point about corporations, not about imperial corporations, just about corporations, that one of the things about corporations is that by allowing people to act as a collectivity and creating this in, this groupthink, it allowed for people to do things that morally or ethically an individual might have trouble doing, right? So what we got was we got conquest in India as a function of our political and social capital, our desire to please each other, our desire to mess with each other. You know, if you had pissed me off over lunch or something, maybe I would have brought that into the game, and that's your idea of a positionality. I found myself, I will say, if I'm going to analyze myself a little bit here, I found myself probably being a little softer because I'm your guest here.
And you didn't say that multiple times.
And I was thinking, like, well, I'm not going to go and I'll be the jerk, or at least until the third or fourth round when I see how things are going.
Yeah,
that imitates the kind of ways in which social capital works.
Yeah.
But I think that that what you're learning about empire is the ways in which decisions about empire can be at a remove from the human costs and the physical costs and be rendered into these ideas of mm-hmm. financial costs. With the, again, because it doesn't account for the decision-making on the ground, you know?
Yeah, so I guess the last question we usually ask folks is, has playing this game or learning this game change the way you think about how you might communicate your expertise to a student or to a public audience in any kind of way?
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, first of all, I think playing this game in and of itself, we were talking about this at some point before we started recording, that I think I'm going to try to find a way to play this game with students.
Great.
Because I think the questions you're asking, they remind me, go back to the literary mm-hmm. analogy, they remind me of when I teach historical fiction or movies. When I talk to students about these sorts of things, I try to get them off of their first instinct, which is to say what's accurate or inaccurate. I mean, I talked about that here, I think, as a way of just talking about what the East India Company was. But when I interpret or judge the game, it's not on the basis of accuracy. It's about this idea of what is able to represent and how it can use its affordances, mm-hmm. I think, to say something, right? For me, I think it reminds me, as someone who thinks more about institutions and how they're structured, it does remind me about the personal and the political that's sort of involved in these kinds of decisions. It's not something that I often emphasize. Again, much like a game designer, an author or researcher is going to focus on what they focus on. And my point is always, like, let other people write other books and we'll all get together and talk about them, not to the exclusion of any one idea. And I do think that even if it's caricatured, if it's missing some dimensions, if it's not able to capture the ways in which these people lived full lives in worlds that exceeded the East India Company, it does show that these decisions that are being made for both in a kind of very uncomfortable or uneven dynamic and balance between people doing their jobs as people trying to make the company better and then people trying to make themselves better in the process. So I guess my answer to you is that it gets me to be able to explain things that I don't maybe emphasize and I should, but it also its absences is a moment where you can think about.
But I like this idea of comparing it to a novel in a classroom space, especially, right? Because the novel will show you some things. It'll show you a particularly mediated representation of a historical event or space, but it never shows you everything. And so a part of the reading of it has to look for those absences and those blindnesses or blind spots, I should say, and sort of uncover those for people. Yeah.
Well, we should, we're way over time, so I want to make sure we're respecting your time and your day.
Well, so, I learned a lot today by playing this game with you and talking with you about your research. So it was a pleasure on our end to have you on the podcast. So thanks
deep
for
conversation.
Well, thanks so for much. Coming. I really appreciate it. I didn't notice the time pass. But thank you so much for having me. This was a really real pleasure, and it was really great to be able to think about the East India Company from this perspective.
Awesome, great. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So we just wrapped the interview with Philip Stern, wonderful guest. We're very excited to have him give over several hours of his time to learning how to play John Company 2nd Edition, and I think he had a pretty good time. It seemed like he was having a lot of fun.
He spoke
poking around that sound box.
At this point in the episode, you know he had lots to say.
Lots and lots to say. About the game, certainly, but also just about his immense expertise in the history of venture colonialism and the East India Company in particular. Mm-hmm. So it's time for us now to do our takeaways and kind of try and distill some takeaways for you and I out of this experience for listeners to consider, but also just, you know, for us to enjoy.
And I think before we go there, we should just mention, too, that we had... This is a special episode because... We had spoken with the designer about this game before we played it on the show. I mean, it was a while ago. Go back in the catalog, check out our conversation with the Whirlies of Whirly Gig Games, and you can get a little more insight into both the things we were talking about with our conversation with Phil, but also what we're about to just
go I guess here. It's also something as a bit of a disclaimer, which maybe we should put out there, is of all of the games on the podcast that we've done episodes with, I believe I am the most familiar with this game. I've played John Company Probably more true. Times than I've played Pax Premier. I've certainly played it more times than I've played Terraforming Mars, which is a game I don't really enjoy. And all the other ones were like first place. It's like,
which
let's try
it. A lot because it is... There's a lot to be familiar with. Well, on that note, do we want to go into our meaningful moments?
Sure, let's do it.
All right.
Do you want to go first?
Sure.
All right.
I'll go first. It's really subtle because we didn't get to play the entire thing with him. And I thought that this came out of not necessarily a condition of that, but a condition of the fact that we weren't going to get to play the whole thing with him because just because of the time crunch. This meaningful moment connects in a weird way. Let me just start by saying that multiple times he made decisions based on the fact that he was a guest on our podcast. Mm-hmm. And that reveals that thing that we talked about later on in our conversation with him, social capital.
Yeah.
Early on in the game, you are trying to purchase good favor by just doing the things that other people want you to do. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's that kind of a game.
Yeah.
And that connects to, perhaps, the feeling that one might have when you are developing a relationship with your professional life or career. Which
as a member of the company you're talking about? Like as a writer or an officer or something?
Sure, yeah. Right? You are probably just going to like take orders like, okay, this is how this is going to work. Apparently that's how we do things. If you come in being like, you know, a boss when you're brand new to the scene, it is
blowhard.
Going to probably be off-putting to some people in that company. And that connects very well to his claim that this game is about that perspective, about being an agent in the machinations of this company from a London perspective.
Yeah.
And that little moment where he was just like, well, I'm a guest on the podcast, you know, bringing in this sort of...
Well, and he didn't know us. He's never played a game with us before either. I think there's also like what I really liked about that comment from him too is that it opens up a moment of insight about the sociality of play more generally, right? That actually when you sit down around a board game with people, if they're strangers, you do feel perhaps a little vulnerable, a little gun-shy. You're not sure how they're going to react to certain behaviors. Mm-hmm. You don't know what the boundaries of behavior are yet, especially if you've never played a game like John Company. And the boundaries for player behavior in John Company are quite wide, and they go into quite distasteful areas, both in terms of what you deal with, which is just abstracted in the game components, but when you deal with each other.
Yes.
I find when I play a game of John Company, this is my first disclaimer moment, when I have played one of these games that does go the full time, and the company either fails or it doesn't, but you play for like 3 to 6 sometimes hours, it's extremely emotionally taxing.
Yes.
It's an extremely emotionally taxing game. And that's aside from the cognitive burden of maybe you're learning it for the first time. Even if you know all the rules by heart, it's an emotionally taxing experience to spend 6 hours squeezing your friends for that extra pound or getting squeezed by your friends for that extra pound or doing these awful things in India in order to try and make some money so you can recoup from your losses from a previous die roll.
And not every game is good at that.
Yeah.
Not every game is good at creating that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the value judgment of good or bad because I'm certain that the designer of this game wanted you to feel that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Wanted you to feel like you were going through a, mm-hmm. like not just a like a quick little foot race, but a marathon.
Yeah.
And you're carrying those early decisions about how you treated other people all the way through a very long slog.
Yeah. Right. I think that that's, yeah, that's, so maybe I'll transition into talking about my moments mm-hmm. here because there's, I don't really have a single one, but they're very closely related to this whole question of player positionality and sociality and behavior around the table. What I think is really cool about what you're pointing out is the way in which the game as a game forces us to engage in these types of things. And those behaviors also mirror in the way that they build over the course of a 5 or 4 hour or 3 hour game, the same trajectory of a person's career where they have to build that social capital at their table or in their office or in their presidency mm-hmm. or whatever. Right. So that's really cool. I think for me, the two moments that stood out were just two of the most impactful things that I did in the like turn and a half that we played. One was I deployed the army of Bombay and I defeated the sovereign rulers of that region mm-hmm. and sort of like put my jackboot down and created a governorship, which actually ended up never getting hired. I did that, earned me a little bit of money, and felt icky, mm-hmm. right, as Philip said. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's, I'm not quite sure what to say about that without going on way too long, but the whole army deployment side of this game, I think is really interesting, mm-hmm. For lots of reasons having to do with like, well, who am I and what are my ways of creating good outcomes for myself? What is the collateral damage of that? What kind of ideological resources do I have at hand to justify this behavior or to paper over it for my own conscience sake? Or maybe I don't care. I mean, that side of it is kind of very much open for players to role play however they want. Right. The other thing I did is I played a blackmail card, which was called Company Fraud, which almost, we didn't tank the company, but that it almost zeroed out the balance. Right. And I had the least shares. So I played it because I wasn't going to give very many dividends anyways. I played it, stole a bunch of money from the company. Mm-hmm. And then you all could only afford to pay out one dividend, which by the way, I also got £1 off of, even though you guys got 2 and 3. So I guess my point here is that like the most meaningful moments in this game were never wholesome. They are sometimes certainly exciting. I mean, I would not, mm-hmm. it's definitely not boring. You know, doing the dice checks, the dice make sure of that, right? Mm-hmm. When I'm rolling for my deploy, it's always like, ooh, okay, am I going to hit it? I only have 4. I had to subtract 1 for the tower level. Oh my gosh, am I going to do it? And then even if you do succeed, we didn't have any officers in that deploy action, but if you do succeed, then you got to roll a death check and maybe your person dies in the conflict. So never wholesome, certainly exciting and sometimes upsetting.
Yes,
and that's kind of like the tagline for this game, I think, that I would give people. Well, it's like never wholesome, always exciting, sometimes upsetting. John Company. That's going to be your experience. And so I guess what's interesting about that for me is in the short time that we played it today, those two moments were the most meaningful and both of them were kind of vile in different ways. One in a kind of like really reprehensible way in which it reproduced like acts of colonial violence. Another in a just kind of like white collar criminal way insofar as I just swindled two of my compatriots out of their fair share of their money. I think that's an interesting...
It did hurt when you did that.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of like thing about it. It makes me wonder why I like this game so much, is my point, because I do quite enjoy playing.
There are these little buckets in my head
of,
you know, how much I hate a person. Mm-hmm. In the game, right?
Yeah.
And when you did that, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
There like several little
several
like drops
little
in the bucket.
Right? Dropped into my bucket. Oh, like he's
and
on
I'm
my
sure
shit list.
The
yeah.
same thing happened for Phil.
Yeah.
Right.
For sure.
We're both like, okay, well, you know, Steve's looking out for Steve. Not us mm-hmm. at all. Right. And so you invested pretty heavily in those buckets for ourselves.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And you weren't playing your long game because we knew we weren't playing the long game.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You maybe still would have made the same decision. So what
well,
about your
I think first turn, if you have Company Fraud first turn, use it. Personally, yeah. That's just a side note to people who play John Company for fun. Mm-hmm. I think because the company's set up to make a lot of money on the
tip
first
from
turn.
The pro. There you go.
Hardly a pro. I've got 5 games under my belt. I'm sure there's people that have played hundreds of times.
What about your unexpected expertise?
You know, this one, again, is always a little tricky in a good way when we play with historians. We've done several episodes with historians now, and like having to pick out one nugget of expertise is always like, oh, geez, what do I choose? I mean, I think for me, I'll point to one specific detail as illustrative of a much broader sort of thing that that came up in his comments over and over again when we talked to him about
corporations. Sort of doing the same thing, so that's good.
So the little detail was just a little side note that he pointed out that, oh, this debt track is really interesting the way this works. That's cool. But, you know, fun fact, in the early days of the company, actually the company was so profitable and the crown was struggling so much that the company was floating the state. And the company was loaning money to the crown. Mm-hmm. And the crown was being propped up by monies from the company. Just didn't know that. That's interesting, right? Because that doesn't figure so much in the single-player game, which uses the crown bot, might have things that which would sort of like enact that for us. But for players in the multiplayer game, you don't. The crown never takes a loan from you. They only like bail you out if you burn royal protections.
I feel like that's the case still today.
Yes. Well, so this is my broader point, right? Is when he said that and talked about debt and the sort of mechanics of debt and debt restructuring that existed throughout the early modern period. It was part and parcel of a repeated theme of his commentary about the history of corporations as a kind of like economic technology or a legal technology. He kept calling them. And it pointed out for me the ways in which like these public-private dilemmas that we confront today. In political discourse, we often hear arguments about public versus private, public interest versus private interest. The private interest is, you know, invading a public space and it's sort of like twisting things to make it profitable for private interest, but it should be done in the public interest. And it sort of threw up for me, and but in reading some of his work and talking to him today, is that public-private dilemma is sort of perennial.
Yes.
And it has always been fraught and it has always been murky. And that's because, like, if you think about feudalism, like feudalism fuses public and private entirely. I am a lord, therefore I control political power, but also I'm rich because I am a lord. Mm-hmm. So I control economic power, right? And so what's interesting about the company form and the joint stock corporation and these sorts of things that he was talking about are the ways in which they seem in our current political climate, we can often point to corporations as these like newfangled things that are invading on like the eternal sovereignty of a public state. But in fact, the public state and the notion of a public state in part was always tied up with these kinds of murky private franchises and charters and state-sponsored monopolies. So it sort of is not surprising at all that these things are always confused and always very fraught, because the notion of a totally sovereign public state that has purview over a realm of economic activity, whether that be healthcare, education, anything like that, any sort of space of economic activity, has maybe never existed. The idea that the notion that there's some sort of like public space that is not confused or enmeshed within these private interests, being somewhat historically naive, I thought was kind of interesting, which I hadn't quite thought about it in that way until I started engaging with him and his work. But it's interesting to track that longer history. I was like, well, of course we have these problems. Look at the way the state formed. The state formed in part through the operations of a bunch of private companies that monarchies had granted patents to.
I had the same revelation from a different perspective. It stems from his comment about members of the parliament having a significant stake in the East India Trading Company. It was a large percentage, right? He didn't have the exact number, but he said potentially a third of the parliament had a stake in that company. And that, again, if we go back to, or if we flash forward to our current time, and we think about the people who are supposedly representatives of the public interest, I bet you, I don't know this for sure, right? Yeah. That there's probably even more egregious percentages.
Well, certainly. And I think the interesting thing about it is that in the historical record, we can track people's portfolios to the extent in which the archival evidence will bear that out. But right now, current people who have much more well-documented portfolios, presumably because they're being actively managed.
Right. And we got the lobbyist problem
have,
now.
They have
right?
public protections, which mean that stuff is not actually open and available information. So it's like the degree to which public and private interest is still hugely mingled is obfuscated by like the legal protections afforded to individuals, but also actors like corporations and
stuff
like that.
But then I started
this.
Thinking about the airline industry, right? It is heavily subsidized by the government.
Yeah.
It's also heavily regulated by the government. And just a few years ago, maybe it's more than a few at this point, but there was that big merger that was proposed that got blocked, right? Because it would have it resulted in a monopoly. Yet I wonder, right, what are the stakes that people hold in those companies who are making those decisions? I thought about the airline example too as a good one, because how does it benefit the public? Right. And yes, the people who are invested in it, sure, there may be public individuals, right, who are making money off of their profits potentially, but also as those resources are regulated, as those companies are regulated, we have perhaps better access to affordable transportation, but which is, I don't know, environmentally problematic. But the other thing is that it's safe.
Yeah.
Right? It is being heavily regulated to be mostly just safe for me to get on a flying metal object, right? And not die, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of where I came from all that stuff. And
yeah.
it's pretty wild the number of ways that public and private connect.
Yeah, and it's just also incredibly crazy to think about a period of time in which, imagine Bezos being the only United States citizen with permission to trade with China.
Yeah, well, we're getting there.
Like, you know, like, it's just amazing the way that goes back to that feudal origin, where it was at this early modern stage, we were transitioning into, like, what is a modern state? Doesn't really exist yet. There's a crown, though. There's a monarchy, and they regulate trade. And what they've said is, you are allowed to trade on this half of the globe.
Yeah, right.
It's like, wow. Okay.
That charter, yeah.
So, yeah, it's just crazy the way that stuff developed. It's also interesting that, like, you know, yes, it was extremely influential. It helped build an empire, and perhaps maybe it was, like, the most important thing of building that empire. Many people have argued, but that's maybe debatable. But it doesn't exist anymore.
So it's clear we got to thinking. That is what's cool about this game, is it is intellectually stimulating.
Yeah. I think that's why maybe I like it so much, because I was asking earlier, like, why do I like this game where I feel terrible about what I'm doing all the time? But I think it poses questions. It asks me to interrogate my position.
Yes.
In a way that most games never ask me to interrogate my position. My position is a very easy assumption. I have to take it on board, inhabit it immediately, and then focus on the externalities that position allows me to influence.
Yeah.
But this game is all about the externalities are crazy. They're totally uncertain. They always will be. What are you up to? What are you doing? How can you intervene in what someone else is doing to make them do something that's better for you than for them? And it's just constantly asking you to think about your position in a way that I don't find that common. So I really like that about it.
As you reminded us, and as Cole, the designer, once stated to us,
yes,
it is kind of really what you bring to the table, right? Mm-hmm. You get out of it what you bring to it. And so let's give it a little test of what we think. How much does it really ask us to do that, right? Because I think that's part of what we're assessing here with our subject matter score. And when we give it a number, right, for those who are new to the show or need a reminder, we're not reviewing this game.
It's not a review. This is not an endorsement or, you know, demerit on the game's design qualities.
This is us thinking critically about what is the goal of this game? How does it articulate that goal through play?
Or even perhaps regardless of its goals, to what extent does it or does it not kind of like communicate something meaningful about the subject matter that it engages.
So let's do this. He's struggling, folks. I can see him looking at his
two notebook. Numbers.
So let's do this. You're going to have to say something here. You ready?
No.
Let's do it. 3, 2, 1, 8.5.
Okay. This is really hard for me. I almost gave this a 7, folks. I was going back and forth between 7 and 8. I just couldn't decide. And then I thought, cop out, 7.5. And I thought, no, choose one. So I chose 8. I chose 8. You said 8.5.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because ultimately, I do not think this is trying to mimic the systems of an actual company. I think it's trying to get us to reflect, like we've already kind of gotten to, the sort of abstractions involved in taking a position at the table as someone who's running a company, how, you know, the cognitive load of sitting at the top of a company has to, and I'm not trying to be apologetic here. I don't want to excuse the bad decisions that people make.
These CEOs really got it tough. Let me tell you, I played John Company once, and being chairman's a hell of a job.
I'm not trying to excuse that at all, but it makes me think about that situation.
Yeah, like, for sure. Yeah,
allowing someone to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, if a company has that much influence on the world, that it can make that somebody sitting at a desk somewhere who is, but for the sake of their brain, forced to abstract the decision they are making. Yet they make that decision, and the trickle-down effect of that creates this like very bad situation for someone half a world away. Yeah. That is unacceptable.
Yeah.
And I feel that when I play this game.
Yeah.
I do feel that way. Like, wow, I made a decision as a chairman. I gave you an extra money, and what you did with it was really not an okay thing.
And not only was it not okay, it also like didn't help me because that's not what I gave it to you for.
Yes, exactly.
So it's like it's just we're losing all around here.
So the sensations I feel make me jack this game way up.
Yeah.
Right. But like we always say on this show.
Yeah.
Right. Try to capture the complexities of something like a company in a game is impossible.
You know, it's to try and make a game about the East India Company that actually was like hard line simulationist, that was like, we're going to give you the realistic experience. Like it's got to be like a some sort of campaign of North Africa type object where we're actually holding committee meetings for hours at a time. But this game doesn't do that, obviously. This game is heavily abstracted. It abstracts all over the place, but in particular ways. And I think that's ultimately why I felt compelled to jockey it between 7 or 8 and didn't want to push it a little higher. I mean, when we gave a subject matter score to PAX Premier last year, which is another worthy gig game, I think I gave it over 9, which maybe was, to be fair, like maybe a little overly enthusiastic looking back on it since we've looked at some other games. But this game in particular, and I don't think that Cole or Drew would object to this because they speak about the game in this way in public forum, but is a kind of a more of a novelistic approach. It's like a historical novel, and it's a satirical novel about the history of empire. So it's not professing or attempting to be a historical document. And so I think necessarily the choices you make, the creative license you take, the abstractions that you produce are going to knock a purely subject matter score down a little bit. For instance, the biggest thing about this is like, I'll say one thing that I've always thought about it, and another thing that came out of it from playing with Phil, always when I played this game, and you'll relate to this, so much of the outcome of this game hinges on not just the uncertainty, which is structured all throughout it, hinges on one moment of uncertainty, and that is the roll for attrition. If you do not roll at the right time for retirement, it does not matter what else happens. And that, I think, goes beyond modeling the like risk of 18th century business ventures. Now you're saying that, okay, so I found myself back at home with a bunch of power in parliament, oodles of pounds, but because I just rolled a D6 wrong, I can do nothing to advance my position.
All right.
You know, that to me is where it becomes a little bit more of just a game, and it's a game, and that's fine. It's a game. And it's like, that's cool. You know, it's not a simulation, and there's nothing wrong with that. The other thing playing with it with Phil is like, well, yeah, what might other things be? Right. It's like, well, what did Clive do when he came? He like tried to buy a peerage. It's like, it's not just about a house or money, so for the sake of money. It's money because money gets you what you do not have as a hereditary privilege. Money could buy you a seat in the House of Lords. You could have a peerage then, which you would bestow to your children and their children and their children for generations.
Yes.
You're moving, leveling up as a social entity in the world, which it comes with a lot of cultural prestige and social privilege that is not purely economic in focus or in motive. Those sorts of things are left out a little bit when you reduce it all to like the prize retirement.
And that is a game design decision as well.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah. They can't just allow you to rake in huge amounts of money and then just steamroll everybody else at the table. Right. Because that would be a pretty boring long form game.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, it would be,
you know, just the person who made the most money would win.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily the case here. And I like that subtlety. So I think that both hurt and gave points back to the subject matter score here.
So those are the things that mark it down for me.
Yeah.
But I did give it an 8, which is very high.
Very high.
And the things that mark it up for me are as follows. I mean, I've said a little bit of this already about like player, how it deals with player position and perspective, especially, which is something that Cole has talked about in regards to this game as well. But the way that it provides a model of the kind of like negotiated uncertainty of corporate leadership, mm-hmm. I think is super compelling. They could actually be applied to a game of any historical period dealing with any kind of corporate entity, right? That has these particular, you might reskin some of the offices, you might restructure how it works. Maybe there's not armies, maybe there's research and development and like blah, 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 or whatever. But way more interesting and fascinating than basically any other economic game I've ever played, like be that worker placement or 18XX or whatever. It really gives you an actually like very kind of disaggregated articulation of agency, which is actually how companies work. It's a bunch of individuals with competing interests and competing personalities and different ideas about things, and they have to all kind of work together but against one another.
Both like and hate each other, and that might change next month.
They kind of have to pull in the same direction, but I think that's brilliant. I think that the game is brilliant in that way, and it models that better than any other board game I think I've ever played. Not that I've played them all. I'm sure there are good ones out there that people would point us to, but that for me, regardless of the kind of historical quibbles that maybe Phil might have drawn out for us a bit more than we would have known otherwise, merits it being a kind of an 8,
right.
I think.
Which connects back to its goal, right?
Yeah.
But like that seems to be the goal of the game, not only just from opening the box, but also we have that privileged insider knowledge of knowing that that's what part of their goal. So,
I would say this just in closing, unless you have a further thought.
Go ahead, let's close
it. In closing, I would say this. If you're at all interested in board games and you don't play them, John Company is a huge ask. It's like saying, would you like to start running? Here's a marathon. I get that. But what I will say to you is don't start with John Company. That's a good way for me to turn people off of the hobby. But I will say it is worth pursuing. Remember that it exists. If you play some lighter games and you enjoy them, consider carving out the time and space dedicated to engage with a game like this. I think it's really rewarding. I think this is me giving my soapbox speech for heavy games, for heavy cardboard. Mm-hmm. No TM, that's a different show, not us. But I think it really can offer experiences to players that you can't get if you play Azul.
Right.
Right. It's like, it's just not the same sort of
storytelling capacity.
Yeah.
Here.
It's not the same kind of animal. And so it is forbidding. It is daunting. It is overwhelming. It's all those things. But if anybody ever wants to play, shoot me a message and I will teach you how to play John Company, because I think it's amazing.
People all right. Play it. Well, call them up. That was great. Thank you very much, Steve. As always.
Thank you, Jordan.
This has been Subject Matter Tabletop.
We'll see you around the table.